From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. With the Democratic presidential ticket now present and accounted for, this week the top John made appearances in Boston and Philadelphia, while the other John stumped solo in Iowa. Meanwhile, President Bush defended the Iraq invasion in Tennessee and toured swing states in the Midwest. There wasn't much novelty in the substance of the speeches, but when it came to the ever-important war of images, it was clear that at least one major element of the race is still up for grabs. According to Paul Waldman, editor-in-chief of the online political journal The Gadflyer, that element is the character flaw that will ultimately define John Kerry. Waldman says reporters always frame campaign coverage with the question, what's this guy's biggest problem?
With Gore, it was that he was supposed to be dishonest. And with Bush, it was supposed to be that he was dumb and inexperienced. Now, when it comes to John Kerry, they really haven't honed it down to one thing. And part of the problem is that the Bush campaign hasn't decided what the one thing they want people to be afraid of about John Kerry is.
Well, let's talk about that. First, there was Kerry as flip-flopper, and then recently Kerry as pessimist, and then Kerry as Massachusetts liberal out of touch with mainstream values.
Senator Kerry is rated as the most liberal member of the United States Senate. And he chose a fellow lawyer who is the fourth most liberal member of the United States Senate.
It's an oldie but a goodie. This goes back to something that happens in election after election. There's kind of an aphorism that Republicans talk about values and Democrats talk about issues. They're going back to this idea that Kerry is from a place that's sort of alien to most Americans, Massachusetts, where strange things are supposed to happen. It's supposed to add up to the idea that Kerry and his ideology are something that's not quite American, that Kerry is somehow different and that George Bush represents their values.
But one thing that you've pointed out is that a new pattern seems to have emerged in the Democratic response to these charges. Instead of the thrust and parry of the traditional fencing match, the Kerry campaign, as you describe it, seems to be countering thrusts, not with parries, but with more thrusts. So when Kerry is charged as a flip-flopper, Kerry says in return, what?
Well, instead of saying, no, I'm not a flip-flopper, he's turned the question back on Bush, saying Bush is stubborn, maybe doesn't flip-flop enough.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they've done with this values question. Now that John Kerry and John Edwards are talking all the time about values and putting traditionally Democratic issues, not abortion and gay marriage, but economics and healthcare in terms of values, they've tried to change the question from do we want a values candidate or a non-values candidate to who has the better sets of values.
Let me tell you what values mean to John Edwards and me. Values means really creating the opportunity and fighting for good jobs that actually allow an American family for a week's work to be able to pay the bills and spend some time with your kids and be able to do better in America. Values mean actually getting ahead. It means fighting for tax cuts for the middle-class families, not just for the wealthiest people in America.
It's a subtle rhetorical shift. It's basically just taking a couple of words like values and morality and throwing them on top of the same argument they'd be making anyway.
Let's talk for a moment about the addition of Edwards to the ticket. Besides helping to erase the short-lived strategy of labeling Kerry a pessimist, there was just a tremendous burst of good vibrations on the part of much of the press corps last week. Do you think reporters have recovered from this fit of enthusiasm?
It may have a day or two left. Everybody seemed to like John Edwards when he was on the trail. That applied to voters and also to reporters. They liked him for a number of reasons. First of all, he was just a nice guy, and he spent a good amount of time cultivating them and being nice to them. They also like him because he's a very skilled storyteller, and that makes for good copy. If I can give you a little example, When John Kerry was interviewed on 60 Minutes, he was asked a question about religion, and this is what he said. I'm going to quote, Abraham Lincoln wisely avoided trying to invoke God on the side of the North or assist the South, but prayed that he was on God's side. I think that's the lesson that John and I would bring to this. We are both people of faith. Now, he got this argument from John Edwards, but listen to what it sounds like when John Edwards tells it, as he did in a debate a few months ago when he was still a presidential candidate. He says, and I quote, there's a wonderful story about Abraham Lincoln during the middle of the Civil War, bringing in a group of leaders, and at the end of the meeting, one of the leaders says, Mr. President, can we pray? Can we please join in prayer that God is on our side? And Abraham Lincoln's response was, I won't join you in that prayer, but I'll join you in a prayer that we're on God's side. Now, Edwards is telling has characters, it has context, it has a moment of tension where Lincoln says he's not going to pray, and then it has the twist at the end. So reporters like the fact that John Edwards is a skillful storyteller, and they also love his kids. and we see little references to young Jack and Emma Claire Edwards pop up all the time.
What could be more American than kids, Paul?
Absolutely. And the fact that John Edwards is from the South has something to do with it, too, because one of the sort of tropes of reporting these days is that being from the South and having a Southern accent is kind of a signal of authenticity. And you can see in stories, they'll mention the fact that he has a Southern accent, which will make him appealing to voters in the Midwest or in places like South Dakota. Now, why would someone from South Dakota care that someone has a Southern accent? Well, as far as reporters are concerned, that's a mark of authenticity, that Edwards is real in a way that someone who comes from Massachusetts might not be.
You know, there was a very interesting New York Times story this week. The New York Times took us inside the Bush-Cheney war room, so to speak. What do you think the lesson of that story was, both for readers and reporters?
Well, I think reporters weren't necessarily being told much they didn't already know, except for some of the nuts and bolts. The machine of spin and counterspin has gotten bigger and bigger and more sophisticated. But the stories that focus on those things don't really do much to help the average citizen who's looking to, you know, figure out who to vote for.
Doesn't it help them be more skeptical of the coverage, though?
Well, there's a fine line, because much of the coverage plays into skepticism. The typical story will start with what I sometimes call the spin-tro. It's the introduction that lays out the other side's spin. So if Kerry goes to visit some working people, then the story will start by saying, in an attempt to show that he's not an out-of-touch elitist, John Kerry went to go visit this shop floor. Mm-hmm. There's so much of that in campaign coverage. In the words of Todd Gitlin, who's a professor at NYU, it can make voters the cognoscenti of their own bamboozlement, but it doesn't really help them very much.
So it's basically you're on a continuous yellow alert for spin.
That's a good way to put it.
Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Paul Waldman is editor-in-chief of The Gadflyer, a liberal online political journal.
Ralph Nader, hater of all things corporate and conglomerate, has a new book out. It's called The Good Fight, Declare Your Independence and Close the Democracy Gap. The irony, as Eric Bollert pointed out in his recent Salon story, Strange Alliance, is that Nader's book is being published by a HarperCollins imprint, and HarperCollins is a property of the media conglomerate News Corp, which is controlled by Rupert Murdoch, the arch-conservative mogul notorious for deploying his troops for Republican causes. Eric, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about Regan Books for a moment. That's the HarperCollins imprint publishing Nader's book. What does it normally publish?
Well, they publish a wide variety. On the political front, they do an awful lot of conservative, and they do an awful lot of Fox personality books. They do Sean Hannity. They do lots of Murdoch writers on the right. But to be fair, they have a wide spectrum. Michael Moore's, not his previous book, the one before that, was out on Regan Books.
I guess congratulations are in order to Regan Books to support a diversity of opinions and not to let ideology get in the way of its publishing decisions, right? Congratulations.
Right, absolutely.
But that's not what your piece said.
Yeah, I mean, it would just sort of be ironic if Ralph Nader from the left, an opponent to corporate influence in government, as well as a critic of media consolidation, signed a book with a Murdoch imprint. I mean, that in and of itself would be sort of ironic. But you could say, well, if Ralph Nader wants to be published in a serious way, he's going to make a deal with a corporation. But the other thing that's going on is Rupert Murdoch does have a history of using his book publishing contracts as a way to sort of reward political allies. And the suspicion is Rupert Murdoch trying to give Nader, you know, a healthy media platform so he can do harm to John Kerry's campaign.
Aha, uh-huh, the vast right-wing conspiracy.
Right.
Now, you do connect the dots in your piece, but I must say the dots are mighty far apart. I guess I can see why it would be sort of fundamentally hypocritical of Nader to take money from a corporation he has called a conglomerate rat. But, I mean, do you have any evidence that Nader is in some way playing ball with Murdoch and that he is seeking to be rewarded for it?
No. And, you know, his spokesman said, if you listen to Ralph on the campaign trail, he's still very critical of corporate America and he's still critical of media consolidation. But I mean, the suspicion is not that Rupert Murdoch gave Ralph Nader a book contract and Ralph Nader decided not to talk about corporate welfare or media consolidation. The idea is he would talk about all the things he always talks about, but, you know, we'll give him a platform with the media and we will help him sort of spread his word. And if by chance he happens to siphon some votes that arguably determine the election, all the power to him. But you're right. I mean, this is not a quid pro quo. It's just another sort of curious example of why are Republican groups sending out emails to get Nader on the ballot? Why are Republican sort of fat cats donating to his campaign? Why are Republican media companies suddenly interested in publishing his book? So it's sort of curious. It is, as we say, a strange alliance.
But there remains the inconvenient little fact of the Michael Moore book about, you know, stupid white men.
Right.
If push came to shove and you had to say, well, I think this is an explicit attempt by Murdoch to support Nader's candidacy because it will help the Republicans, or that it's just Regan Books behaving the way Regan Books behaves and looking to make money on another piece of political nonfiction, if your life depended on it, which would you really think is what's going on here?
It's impossible to tell. I mean, you know, Rupert Murdoch obviously didn't know that this book got signed, but as we've seen with Fox News, this isn't a top-down organization. Everyone sort of knows the rules of engagement when it comes to politics at News Corp, and everyone sort of understands where that ship is going. The other thing, you mentioned the Michael Moore book, and so did I, you know, as Salon wrote at the time, that book came out only after Michael Moore accused Regan Books of trying to censor a couple of chapters that it deemed was too negative towards George Bush in the light of the 9/11 attacks. This came out a few months after that. You know, even when they publish someone on the left, they have run into these hurdles in terms of accusations of censorship and things like that. And the other thing I would just note is Ralph Nader's previous book, which came out after the 2000 election, when there was probably the most interest in him, sold about 45,000 copies. So there's almost no way that publisher made a profit. So it's interesting that Murdoch would be interested in Nader as an author after what most people would consider a rather modest showing at the bookstores in 2001.
All right, Eric, no smoking gun, no corpus delicti even, but it's a pretty good mystery. Thanks very much.
Sure, no problem.
Eric Bollert's story, Strange Alliance, is available on Salon.com. He joined us from the studios of WBGO in Newark, New Jersey.
Coming up, more on the potential impact of media consolidation, and the no longer mysterious Mr. Z strikes back at the Gray Lady.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This spring, the Beacon Press released a revised and updated version of one of the century's most important works of media criticism. Ben Bagdikian's original The Media Monopoly is an examination of the concentration of American mass media outlets in the hands of very few corporations. Critics called it alarmist, but 20 years later, it looks like Ben Bagdikian was right on target. The new version, The New Media Monopoly, describes a media environment much more concentrated and cartel-like than it was in 1983. With five corporations controlling most of the airwaves and presses in the country, even those original critics must agree that something unprecedented is happening to American media. Ben Bagdikian joins us now. Ben, welcome to On the Media.
Glad to be here.
Did you ever see a Jimmy Stewart movie called The Billy Mitchell Story?
Yes, I did.
Okay, well, allow me, please, to remind listeners that Billy Mitchell was a pioneering aviator, sort of the father of the Army Air Corps. And there is this dramatic scene in the film from like 1930 when he scandalizes the world by predicting that the Japanese would bomb the United States. Now, he was dismissed as hysterical and alarmist and irresponsible. But 12 years later, lo and behold. So my question is, how does it feel to be Billy Mitchell?
Well, I don't fly airplanes anymore, but the analogy, I think, is a grand one. I think, if anything, what I've done by the original book and subsequent rewriting of this book is to predict that as the communications on which most Americans say they depend become controlled by a handful of corporations, that what is served to the public is what these corporations decide they want to say and what they don't want to say. And one of the themes that runs through the book is that media power is political power.
Well, you've been singing this tune for more than 20 years. What's changed since 1983?
I have to say that every edition of the book I put out was obsolete the day it came out, because I have, in every edition, underestimated the arrogance and power and the what I regard as disservice of the corporations as they became more powerful. The techniques of violence, of sex, are very good audience collectors. How much that does for democracy is a good question.
You've said that with every edition of your book, you find that it's obsolete at the date of publishing. Do you think with this latest edition that at long last you'll be able to look at it in a couple of years and say, well, just this one time I've overreacted?
Well, I must say, even though I have cases in the new book of the grossest kind of censorship, I would not have imagined at the time the book went to press that Disney would make a movie that was sure to make a lot of money and not put it out because it was politically damaging to the administration, which, of course, appoints the FCC majority, which the present operators like. I was not able to imagine that they would go that far, but they did. They rejected their own picture.
You, of course, are talking about Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, which was supposed to be distributed by Disney until Chairman Michael Eisner said he wouldn't allow it. Disney sold it to Harvey and Bob Weinstein, his own employees, actually, at Miramax. They found new distributors in the movie, opened across the country, and became the highest grossing documentary in history. I want to ask you about the future. Is it possible that the internet is exactly the diverse and democratizing force that could counterbalance the effects of media monopoly as we know it now?
I completely agree that it is the bright light on the horizon, and it has had a very real effect. One organization on the internet got tens and hundreds of thousands of people to march against the Iraqi invasion, and it demonstrated that power. So money still rules the roost, but there are chinks in that whole alignment of the big operators. But they remain there. They're powerful. In my book, I say that the people who control most of what the American public reads, sees, hears, can fit in a generous phone booth. 20 years ago, they needed a small ballroom.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
An updated edition of Ben Bagdikian's groundbreaking work, Media Monopoly, now titled The New Media Monopoly, is published by the Beacon Press. For decades, Ben Bagdikian was a lonesome David facing down a menacing Goliath. We learned last week, however, that sometimes, as in the Bible tale, the advantage can revert to David. The latest confrontation of big media and the plucky little guy has come to a negotiated settlement and huge PR victory for the advocacy group Project Billboard. That organization had contracted for a billboard in New York's Times Square for an anti-war message, only to have the message rejected by the billboard's owner on the stated grounds that the accompanying image of a bomb was potentially unnerving for New Yorkers. Never mind that the bomb was not a terrorist one, but a military one, wrapped in red, white, and blue, accompanied by the message, "Democracy is taught by example, not by war." The owner was nervous about the political content, and so was the management of the hotel on which the board rests, whose own contract gives it veto power, and said, "Not on our roof." Oh, did I mention that the board's owner is the media colossus Clear Channel, whose nervousness about political content historically has hinged on whether the content was for or against the Bush administration? Oh, and that the board was scheduled for the week of the Republican National Convention? When Clear Channel produced a previously undisclosed rider referring to the hotel's veto option, Project Billboard rushed into court screaming of censorship. "They seem to think they can suppress free speech," said the group's director, Deborah Rappaport. Well, of course they can suppress free speech. The First Amendment applies to governments, not private parties, hence the central argument against media consolidation. when the freedom to suppress speech is enjoyed by a handful of corporations instead of many outlets with diverse viewpoints, democracy is threatened. Hard to know if it was prompted by naivete or cunning, but the protest group's court case and associated publicity brouhaha suggests a power shift in the fight against media consolidation. Project Billboard's Deborah Rappaport on the courthouse steps.
You know, I won't lie and say that, you know, the publicity isn't here, because obviously you folks are all here.
The case wasn't litigation so much as it was judo, employing leverage to turn the size and strength of the opponent against him. Clear Channel flexed its market muscle, Little Project Billboard thrust out its hip, and the rushing brute wound up prostrate, agreeing, okay, okay, you can have two billboards elsewhere in Times Square instead of one. Just switch out the bomb for a dove. Done. What we learned last year when grassroots outrage eventually stymied the FCC's attempt to further deregulate media ownership has been proven again. The public interest can truly be served when the public gets interested. The mere fear of backlash has shamed Goliath out of exercising his explicit legal rights. Works for me. Now it's time for Congress to be shamed into restoring the safeguards against media concentration. Renewed regulation can neutralize Clear Channel and News Corp and Viacom and the 900-pound broadband gorilla Comcast. Doesn't take muscle, just a little leverage.
And now an update. Last month, we reported that the widely admired TV anchorman Leonid Parfionov was fired from the nominally independent NTV network in Moscow for airing an interview with the widow of a Chechen leader murdered by Russian security services. At the time, Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor told us to keep our eye on Savik Schuster, host of NTV's freewheeling political news program Svoboda Slova, Freedom of Speech. This week, that program died. And there was another death in Moscow, a real one. The murder last Friday of the editor-in-chief of Forbes Russia, Paul Klebnikov. He was American of Russian descent, an investigative reporter who firmly believed, his friends say, in a better future for Russia. It is very rare that an American reporter is murdered in Russia, but it's all too common these days for the native-born. The New York Times noted that 14 journalists have been shot since Vladimir Putin became president. Not one of the murders has been solved.
This week, the New York Times and its columnist Nicholas Kristof were slapped with lawsuits by former government scientist Stephen J. Hatfill. In 2002, Hatfill was named a, quote, person of interest in the anthrax attacks that terrorized the nation and killed five people. No one was ever charged, but Hatfill was the focus of several of Kristof's columns, identified as Mr. Z, a bioterrorism expert whose activities were suspicious, to say the least. Hatfill's suit charges Pulitzer Prize-winning Kristof with defamation. It's likely that much of the information cited in Kristof's columns was leaked by investigators on the case. When Hatfill first aired his complaints in August of 2002, Brooke looked at how law enforcement uses the media to send up trial balloons.
We've seen this sort of thing before, a presumption of guilt before the facts are in, what appears to be the sweating of suspects by law enforcement through anonymous leaks in the press. There are the notorious examples of presumed Atlanta bomber Richard Jewell and presumed spy Wen-Ho Lee. Now there's presumed anthrax attacker Stephen Hatfill. Nick Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times.
You know, if you look back at how the media has handled various cases, then we really have at times ruin the lives of people by tossing their names out there before they've been subject to any kind of criminal process, and when our presumption has to be that they're innocent and just caught in this incredible nightmare.
Yet over the past few months, Kristof has assiduously compiled and reported an impressive but entirely circumstantial case against the man he called Mr. Z. His unique access to the precise kind of anthrax used in the attacks that killed five people, his poor showing on three polygraph tests. He reported Z's own claim to have taken part in the actions of the White Army in Rhodesia, where there is evidence that in the late 70s, anthrax was released and sickened 10,000 blacks. But Kristof never used Stephen Hatfield's name, and he says his intention never was to convict Mr. Z.
It was to light a fire under the FBI. I think the FBI did a catastrophic job for months and months and months. I think they weren't prepared to deal with a high-tech scientific investigation like this. It took them months to catch up.
And to keep it hot for the FBI, Kristof piled on the circumstantial fuel, Z's foreign trips, his alias, and stray remarks that have since been rebutted in other newspapers. Kristof's impatience was fed by experts in the community of bioterror and within the FBI itself, but he always stopped short of naming Mr. Z, even after others did, until Hatfield himself came forward.
It's a very awkward position. This is a crucial public policy issue and a fundamental matter of avoiding terrorism in the future as well. And so we have to investigate, we have to report it, and yet we don't want to make the mistakes that we did in the past.
The mistake cited by Hatfield's lawyer was the media frenzy over Richard Jewell, an innocent man who became a prime suspect in an Atlanta bombing during the 1996 Olympic Games. Suspicion fell on Jewell early in the investigation, but as in Hatfield's case, there was no physical evidence, and so anonymous officials in law enforcement, perhaps the police, perhaps the FBI, or both, fed the press with hints and suppositions. When Richard Jewell was invoked in Hatfield's case, many in the media declared that he was being railroaded in the very same way, but reporters on this case did not rush what they were learning into print. Though they knew his name, they held back for months.
I don't think there's a serious journalist in America covering these issues who was not thinking about the Richard Jewell case and about the Wen Ho Lee case as they were reporting on the anthrax investigations.
Newsweek's Dan Kliveman reported on Richard Jewell and Wen Ho Lee and now Stephen Hatfield. In fact, he reported what appears to be a leak that could only have come from the FBI. Trained dogs were exposed to odors derived from the anthrax letters. Then they were exposed to various people and places. The dogs reacted to Hatfield's apartment, his girlfriend's apartment, and restaurants he'd recently patronized, but to no other people or places. Nick Kristof.
That, I understand, was very closely held within the FBI by only a very small number of people and was reported within about 2 or 3 days of the FBI itself knowing that.
They thought, aha, we have a breakthrough, but then realized, well, but we don't have any physical evidence tying him to the crime.
Kliveman says FBI leaks are very rare, and so does Ronald Kessler, a former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and The Washington Post who writes extensively on the FBI. But he notes the FBI will make use of the media to sweat out a suspect. For instance, when an anniversary of an unsolved murder approaches, the Bureau may prod the press for a follow-up because it may spur the killer to visit the gravesite.
FBI agents are there videotaping, and they actually have caught the suspects in these cases. That shows how the press can be used to try to solve crimes.
In Hatfield's case, Kessler suggests the leaks are similarly strategic.
The purpose of these leaks is to try to shake up the suspect and see what he'll do and see if more evidence can be obtained that way. It's almost unheard of for FBI investigations to be leaked, you know, with some exceptions. And the fact that this is happening, I think, indicates that there is this motive involved.
Reporters often say that the motives of leakers are irrelevant if the information checks out. And in this case, New York Times columnist Nick Kristof contends the need is great and that Hatfield's story has not played out, like Richard Jewell's. But he also says he's guided by a story he watched unfold as a reporter in Japan when a Mr. Kono was falsely accused of releasing sarin nerve gas in Matsumoto.
It was just an epic tragedy. His wife was comatose in this attack. I was wondering, you know, how the U.S. press would have handled it. And I thought that, in fact, we would have done even worse for Mr. Kono, because the Japanese press, for the most part, did not name him. In the U.S., we would have. We would have written about where his kids were.
But, he adds, if the Japanese press had been less deferential in its treatment of a suspicious cult called Om Shinrikyo, perhaps that gas attack and the one that followed in the Tokyo subway never would have happened.
In the U.S., we would have been much harder on Kono, but we also would have been much, much harder and tougher on Om Shinrikyo. We would have had people pretend to join the cult and write about it. And I think very likely, the result would have been that the cult would have been closed down before it ever had a chance to spread the gas in the subway attacks. And so, you know, it's a two-edged sword. It's an enormously sensitive problem. It's a headache for all of us. But I don't think the answer is always just to pull back completely and not to investigate. I think that's a mistake.
Since Hadfield issued his heartfelt defense before the cameras, the pendulum has swung in favor of Hadfield as victim. As the case develops, inevitably the public will make its judgments and unmake them in turn. But if there were no pendulum, would we really be better off? Nick Kristof helped to energize what some call aggressive investigation, others a witch hunt, with his portraits of the suspicious Mr. Z. Perhaps the best any reporter can do is consider the facts and stick to the Z until the Z comes forward.
Up next, what people meters may do to television, and why the decline in pleasure reading may not mean the collapse of civilization.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For decades, TV ratings were based on handwritten diaries kept by so-called Nielsen families. Over time, far more accurate electronic devices called people meters have replaced the diaries to gauge national ratings. But those ratings show that television audiences for broadcast programs are smaller than the diaries suggested. So now that people meters are being introduced to measure local viewership, the technology has hit a wall of resistance from a group of broadcasters headed by Fox Network's parent company News Corp, and including Spanish-language network Univision and CBS. Siding with them is a newly formed coalition of ethnic minorities called Don't Count Us Out, which says its constituencies will be undercounted and therefore underserved by broadcasters. This Thursday, in a Senate hearing, representatives of Fox and Univision faced off against Nielsen CEO Susan Whiting. The hearing became so acrimonious that Subcommittee Chairman Conrad Burns felt moved to warn against fisticuffs. In the end, though, lawmakers rejected calls for a regulatory solution and simply asked Nielsen to refine its sampling process. Joining me now is Simon Applebaum, contributing editor to Cable World magazine. Simon, welcome to the show.
Great being here, Bob.
One of the odd bedfellow pairings in all of this is this Don't Count Us Out coalition and the Fox Network's corporate parent News Corp. Tell me how these two came to be on the same side of this fight.
Well, this started out as a private fight. Fox raised some discrepancies based on some sample people meter data that they saw. They raised the issue with Nielsen. Apparently, they couldn't make the ends meet. And Fox apparently went to this group, got them going, and did fund them to a certain degree.
So if it was a grassroots organization, Fox was the Scott's turf builder.
You could say that. And by the way, we don't know who is the executive director of this organization. We don't know what the makeup is. This is a coalition where there are organizations in the coalition, but there's no specific central organization that's running things.
It's true that News Corp may be just losing sleep at night, worrying about the minority population and whether they're getting the TV programs they want and deserve. Or you could say they are just simply manipulating this group in order to flog Fox's business interests.
You could say that. When these people meters are deployed, it generally does show that broadcast network television viewing is down and cable network viewing is up. The irony is that some of that viewership that Fox may be losing with its stations or its network may be going to its cable services, whether it's Fox News Channel or FX or Fox Sportsnet. Another irony here is that for years, Univision did pose an issue with Nielsen about concerns about being undercounted. Univision is now the largest Spanish-language network. Ratings are high. They dominate over Telemundo, as well as other broadcast and cable nets in the Spanish language. But they're getting competition, and they are concerned that if these people meters are deployed, that network rating, and more importantly, their station ratings, are going to go down. And that's why probably they're getting involved in this controversy.
Nielsen has argued that because the previous measurements were so unscientific that they overestimated ratings, any adjustment is bound to look as though undercounting is going on, whether for a minority population or not. Do they have a point on that?
They do, Bob, because the previous system was one of memory. It was diaries. You had to fill them out month by month. And in an era where you have now not only analog but digital cable services, you have the personal video recorder, you've got more broadcast networks, to memorize all of what you're watching and where you're watching it and what dial position is tough. The people meter has been around nationally for some time. It's proven that it works. Everyone involved in this whole issue, whether it's Don't Count Us Out or Fox or Univision, will say it works. The issue is how it's being implemented, how many people from people of color groups are involved, and more importantly, what comes out of that data.
Now, there's an interesting footnote to all of this, and that is as local TV ratings are determined several times a year, there's a period called sweeps when there's a very close focus on who is watching and a very detailed demographic breakdown. What has corresponded with sweeps has been a lot of very lurid programming. If the people meters are deployed in most cities in the United States, will that mean that sweeps will no longer be used to pump the audience in any given market at any given time?
Probably. I think it will definitely lead to more focus, if you will, on programming year-round and making every month count. One of the reasons why cable is where it is because the programmers, whether it is HBO or ESPN or CNN, use and do original programming each and every month. There is no sweeps period. There's going to be some tinkering here, but I think that's what you're going to see is the broadcast networks go into a year-round schedule where every month is critical and every month is important.
Well, Simon, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Simon Applebaum is editor-at-large of Cable World magazine.
A plague on people meters and all that they imply. According to Andrew Solomon, writing in last week's New York Times, TV turns our minds off. Indeed, he condemned electronic media in general as torpid. Solomon was riffing on a recent survey by the National Endowment for the Arts, which found that reading for pleasure has nosedived in America. And that's too bad, the NEA notes, because pleasure readers are more likely to volunteer in their communities and attend museums and sporting events than couch potatoes. Solomon bemoaned, "There is a basic social divide between those for whom life is an accrual of fresh experience and knowledge and those for whom maturity is a process of mental atrophy. The shift toward the latter category is frightening." Doing its part to arrest that downward spiral, this week the New York Times serialized The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. We know reading is sound mental hygiene, and watching stuff, on big screens or small, is cerebral sloth. We know that, but is it true? For a contrarian's view, we called on new media visionary Douglas Rushkoff. Doug, thanks for coming on.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, as a radio person, I naturally take umbrage at Solomon's characterization of the electronic media as torpid. I mean, there's good radio and bad, and good TV and bad, and good websites and bad, and yeah, good novels and bad.
Well, sure. It was funny. When I was listening to his description of TV and electronic media, I was started to think about Cervantes and Don Quixote. You know, when the novel first came out, it was looked at as just as torpid and, you know, Madame Bovary, you know, the effect of a lot of these different forms of literature on people was thought to be, you know, just terrible. I think that people were concerned that readers were spending more time in fantasy worlds, you know, hypnotized by this, you know, very new and captivating medium rather than spending time in the real world. And of course, now that it's our classic literature or opera is our classic stage form, we look at them as, you know, great high art.
Ah, but you see, Solomon says that good electronic media are never as good as a good book because a book talks to you while electronic media talk at you.
You know, he's chosen a different preposition, but there's no real basis for that. I mean, I can argue that a book only talks at me because the author is dead, or the author is in some house sitting in, you know, in Maine, whereas when you go online, how many novels have comments fields after them where I can talk back? Very few, if any.
But, I mean, I don't think that that's what Solomon meant.
No, what Solomon's talking about is the fact that anybody who's reading a book is being active in that they are actively imagining the scenes and the emotions that are being portrayed. And people who understand how that happens with literature are sometimes very confused about how that might happen with television or film. The fact is, film has a grammar, television has a grammar, their edit points, their conventions. In order to actually make sense, as most 12-year-olds can, of a show like 24, not that 24 is a great show, but it's a complex show, the job required to tie that thing together, to understand the simultaneous action, is pretty active indeed. It's not as active as getting online, getting your hands on the keyboard, but to me it's indicative of the direction that even the most passive forms of television are going.
But what about TV? I mean, the culture has coarsened, right? And the media, and television particularly, is usually blamed for that. There's some truth to that charge, right?
Definitely. I mean, television, I look at as sort of a step on the way, you know, to the internet and interactive media. You know, the evolution of the television into an interactive monitor really didn't take that long. You know, it took a lot less time than the evolution of the epic poem to the play or the play to the novel.
How do you think that reading changed the world?
You know, it empowered people to start seeing things as stories. People feel in command of history. There's some downsides to it, as some of the great early media theorists, you know, like Walter Ong or Marshall McLuhan would say, is that it led to a more abstract culture. You know, we all end up sort of alone in our drawing rooms, you know, reading literature. It led to specialization, and it led to really the fragmentation that was then even more exacerbated by television, where not just each individual family, but each member of the family seems to be in their own room watching their own monitor. You know, America is like a nation of 250 million, you know, markets of one. And it is isolating, it is alienating. But I would argue that the way through that is not to retreat back to the novel, but to use the new tools that are at our disposal in order to begin to forge new communities.
Well, what do you think about the NEA's finding that readers are more engaged in their communities?
Well, that could be possible, but I don't think that figure is going to last very long. You know, when we live in a world where people end up creating political organizations by going online and doing meetup, or they find out how to become part of a WTO protest by, you know, reading a blog, I think we might have to start reevaluating whether, you know, sitting with the Great Gatsby is really the quality that's most indicative of a person who's going to be active in the real world.
All right. Douglas Rushkoff, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Douglas Rushkoff has just published a graphic novel called Club Zero G, an adult anime adventure. His book, Coercion, won the Marshall McLuhan Award for Best Media Book in 2002.
Aspiring filmmakers are taking advantage of new technology, saving money and effort by using digital video to turn their stories into movies. And that's inspired some unusual events, like the recent 5th annual DigiFest Southwest Shootout in New Mexico. The goal's to train new talent and maybe shake up Hollywood a bit. OTM's Paul Ingalls checked it out.
Okay. Action!
Okay, here's the scenario. 7 novice screenwriters gather in Albuquerque, each hoping to create a gem of a film from their storyline.
When 2 neglected boys embark upon an adventure to become real cowboys, the spirit of the Old West has festive play with their fantasies.
It's a story about 2 people who are down and out and really need love and just may find it.
A film about unrequited love except between a father and a daughter.
A bickering family driving through the desert, pulls off to an abandoned gas station and has an unpleasant surprise when they find a dead body, and then hijinks ensue from there.
Scotty Milder, Hawthorne Flaherty, Ryle Adamson, Betsy Burke, and three others each get a 25-person crew, an expensive video camera, and 7 days to make an 11-minute movie. They're all volunteer crews or a mix of knowledgeable pros, locals with some experience, and outright beginners. It's 6:30 Saturday morning. All the crews and equipment trucks are gathered in front of the historic Chemo Theater on Old Route 66 for the official start.
So ladies and gentlemen, start your engines. Let's go.
The crews race off to their locations. The rules prevent any early setup.
All right, everybody out of my way!
That's Albuquerque writer-director Ryle Adamson, who leads his crew to its first location, a nearby strip club. Local actor Julia Thudium will play a stripper on crack who's looking for love. It's another dividend of the DigiFest that she and other local talent get starring roles instead of the one-line walk-ons they normally get on visiting Hollywood productions.
My background is in circus clowning, so there's not a lot of crackhead strippers that I've run into in my life. I don't know how to smoke crack, but I got a lesson. It's weird.
Okay, we're going to get Monty and Leroy's POV of Wayne pulling up.
It's day three at the location for cowboys in an old mining town about an hour's drive from Albuquerque. Everyone looks a bit drawn from the long commutes, the New Mexico sun, and the challenge of coaxing performances out of the film's stars, 2 8-year-old local boys. The director of photography, John Burke, is pressing to stay on schedule. The first shot of the day is already taking too long. The mic boom the rookie sound man's brought is too short.
Just stick your boom out there now. Let's see what you can get. See, you can't get out there with that. Come on, you guys.
The farther you get out of town, out of Albuquerque, the more tension you have, because you're competing for time here.
Jim Grabner is the stocky, bearded director of the nonprofit New Mexico Digital Filmmaking Institute that sponsors this event and year-round technical training classes.
So if you're out of town, like in this case, 60 miles out of town, your camera's coming back late, your lunches are going out late, and everybody's feeling that added pressure. The shoots that are in town are the easiest shoots.
This will become the second journey.
The Scarlet Momentum crew is shooting in town, and there seems to be a relaxed energy as the team transforms a lunchroom in an Albuquerque office building into a mortuary. Michael Flowers is the art director.
We're about to make bile. I discovered the perfect recipe is Mountain Dew and aloe vera hair gel.
That's going to be a critical part of the background here?
Well, one of the corpses gets split open and bile rushes all over the floor.
Good luck. I'll be looking for your bile.
Let's see if this works and if we have an acceptable level of sound.
The Widow McCleary is expecting me, and this isn't the place for such a young girl.
It's now day six. All the movies are shot, and editing time is running out. But Scarlet Momentum editor Ron Haas sits calmly adjusting audio levels at his workstation amid crumpled pretzel bags, drained coffee cups, and a nearly empty pack of Camels.
This is usually about the time where I say, don't come near me, because I'm really on the edge of losing control. But this year has been really relaxed and very productive.
In an editing bay next door, it's a different mood, as Cowboys director Betsy Burke and three of her crew struggle with a scene while passing around a bag of popcorn.
That's about as far as we're going to get out of it.
No, we can't even get that far.
Dump by then, you won't even know.
I don't want that in there.
Ready or not, it's screening night for the 7 DigiFest films at a plush downtown auditorium. Awards to be handed out sparkle on a table next to the screen. Cowboys director Betsy Burke arrives wearing a wispy dress and a too small cowboy hat.
I'm as excited I am. I'm so nervous I feel like I could pretty much throw up right now.
Michael Flaherty of Scarlet Momentum wears a festive Scottish kilt and admits to butterflies.
It's a heavy film, and it came out exactly how I wanted it to come out. And that's why I'm nervous, because we could have done some things and pulled back in certain places and made it a little easier to watch, and we didn't.
The crews act like troop mates at the end of scout camp when their own film hits the screen. The movies look good thanks to the $50,000 high definition cameras. The exteriors on Cowboys are stunning, and the young actors charm the audience.
Ready to go?
Where?
To the mountains to be real cowboys.
but it's the very dark and dramatic Scarlet Momentum, with its corpses, bile, hints of incest, and suicide ending, that sweeps most of the awards.
Scarlet Momentum.
All these films will be considered for air on HDNet TV, the cable network specializing in high-definition content. Some movies will be entered in other festivals. And the best part, according to DigiFest organizers, is that a number of their trainees and local actors impressed visiting producers enough to get offers to work for pay on upcoming feature films. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Mike Vuolo and Kasef and Jesse Graham, and editing help from Sharon Ball. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.